I'm happy now to welcome to the program Ed Fenimore. He's an astrophysicist. He's a laboratory fellow at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, thank you.
So what are black holes?
Yes, well, black holes are the end result of the evolution of stars. Stars are born and they die, and this is one way that they die. They die by making a black hole. So it's the very large stars that end up as black holes. So our sun is not going to become a black hole. But if our sun was 10 to 30 times bigger, it could evolve into a black hole in another billion years or so. So they're the end result of the birth and death of stars.
Birth and death are concepts that we think of in terms of biological life, and evolution is a word that you also used, and we all always think about those things, and it seems like when we use them for stars and black holes and astronomical phenomena, are those metaphors, or are they birth and death and evolution the way biological life is?
Well, they're fairly good metaphors. In the beginning, after the Big Bang, there was just a lot of material. That material pulled itself together into the very first stars. And but those stars grew old, and most of them, a lot of them blew up and put that material back into space. So there is a cycle of life. It started out as dust and gas. They formed stars. The stars blew up, put the dust and gas back into the universe. And then the universe made new stars out of those.
Is there something about matter that on some level it wants to form into coherent entities?
Yes. Gravity. All matter has gravity. So the matter pulls itself together, and that's how these stars form themselves out of primordial dust and gas. So they pull themselves together. They make the stars. The stars grow. And there's also an element of evolution here, too, because within the Big Bang only made hydrogen and helium. That's all it made. So, but if we look around us, we see carbon, we see gold, we see oxygen. You know, where did those elements come from? Well, they came from the stars. They came from this cycle of life of the stars. The very first stars, of course, were only made out of hydrogen and helium because there was only hydrogen and helium there. But when they grew, after they evolved, used up all their energy, they blew up, but they had made carbon, all the elements we knew. They had made carbon and nitrogen. So as we look at ourselves, we have to realize that all the material, most of the material in our bodies, was once inside a star in this evolution of stellar material.
In that evolution from hydrogen and helium into the other elements, do we know what order it went in? What were the earliest next elements that were formed?
Oh, yes. In fact, it's amazing how we have that whole process worked out in great detail. In fact, one of the crowning proofs of it and crowning achievements of 20th century science was explaining all of that. I mean, right now, you can effectively go outside and pick up a handful of dirt, and you can ask, well, how much iron is in this? How much cobalt is in this? How much of all the elements? And that pattern of how much each element is there is exactly matches the pattern of how the material is formed inside these stars. So it was, just sort of overwhelming proof that we know those connections. There's just still some details to be worked out on it for some of the very heavy elements. But almost all the elements, we know very, very well who they came from and how they evolved inside stars. So the stars started out with hydrogen and helium. The hydrogen formed into helium. The helium, you can put three heliums together and make carbon. You can, I think, add
another
one.
So kind of carbon was number three?
Well, carbon is very common. I mean, there's some intermediate steps that are in the nuclear reactions, but basically, it's one of the first ones that were formed. And then you build up through silicon. It turns out iron is the most stable element. So once it reaches iron, you can't get more energy by putting elements together. You can put together heliums and make carbon, and you get energy from that. But once you put together iron, you can't make it any more stable. And that's when the stars run out of energy. It's after they burn everything and they become effectively 100% iron that they cannot get any more energy. and then the relentless force of gravity wants to keeps crushing them, and that's what causes the death of these stars, is they've used up all their all the source of energy by making iron, and then they gravity is there to crunch them down, and there's no new source of energy to hold them up, and the stars collapse, and that's the death of the stars. And
that's the black holes?
Well, if it's a very large star, the gravity is so strong it'll crush it into a black hole. If it's a somewhat smaller star, it'll crush it into something the size of Santa Fe, called a neutron star. And if it's...
Something the size of Santa Fe after being hundreds of times the size of...
A million times the size of Earth.
Of the Earth, and yes. And maybe much larger than our sun.
Yes, so it's very, very dense. I mean, all that material is effectively crunched down into a star that is just the size of Santa Fe.
And is invisible.
Well, we see those all the time. No, you can see them.
Are they emitting light?
Yes, but they emit also radio waves. And so we typically see them by how they emit their radio waves.
And what happens to them then?
They're very stable. They can last for the rest of the universe like that, probably. Most stars are in binary pairs. And so in some cases, it starts to rob material from its companion as this binary pair, and it can become too heavy to be a neutron star, and it can collapse into a black hole.
So what are the properties of a black hole, and how do you detect them?
Well, the thing about a black hole is that it has collapsed so much that it's actually gone to zero size.
Zero size.
Zero size. Okay, it has zero radius.
And what does it have any matter left at all?
Oh, yeah, it's very, very heavy. And that's the key to them. They're very, very heavy. They have all the mass of the entire sun.
We learned in science class that if it has weight, then it has to have some size. But that's not true on that scale.
That's not true on this scale.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, it can collapse. And a lot of this goes to Einstein's theory of how gravity works. I mean, gravity is the most important force in astrophysics. It drives just everything. And in this case, one can think of gravity as that it bends the space. Just like if you think of space as being a rubber sheet, if you put a bowling ball on it, it stretches that rubber sheet. If you throw in a golf ball, the golf ball falls towards the bowling ball. And in fact, that's a lot how gravity works. Very large masses bend the space. If you throw something at it, it hits it. They come together because how the space is bent. But as it bends the space, one of the key things is it sort of makes more space. If you take a rubber sheet and measure it, and so maybe it's 2 feet by 2 feet, you put a bowling ball on it, it's bigger.
Okay. What is the equivalent in space of the rubber sheet?
The space itself. The space itself.
Emptiness.
The vacuum acts like this rubber sheet.
So it's sort of counterintuitive to think that something that is empty can be changed in shape.
That's true, but that's how nature has been put together. Mm-hmm. So when it bends it, it makes more space, and that's the key to how you can put a huge mass in a very small area. It looks small to us, but the space itself is actually infinite in size. It has been stretched infinitely. And that's also why it becomes effectively a black hole, because if it makes light, it has to go an infinite distance to get out of the black hole. And so the light cannot get out of the black hole because the mass has stretched the space so much that it's an infinite distance for the light to escape, and the light doesn't come out. And so that's why we call them black holes.
We're talking to astrophysicist Ed Fenimore. So you are also talking about something called gamma ray bursts. What are those?
They're really amazing. They were discovered at Los Alamos in the very early 70s. And Los Alamos was really beginning of the space age, and we were putting up instruments to verify treaties. We had treaties with the Russians that nobody would set off nuclear weapons in space. And one of the things that a nuclear weapon in space does is make a big burst of gamma rays. So we build instruments to look for big bursts of gamma rays, but we didn't have to worry there'd be false alarms because there's nothing out there that makes big bursts of gamma rays, supposedly.
Or so you thought.
Or so we thought. And then we discovered that there were big bursts of gamma rays.
And now, let's back up for 1 second. Explain briefly to our listeners what gamma rays are.
Well, gamma rays are like X-rays, which is actually like light. It's just light that we can't see. Our eyes cannot see X-rays. And gamma rays just have higher energies.
So they're very high on the electromagnetic spectrum.
They're very high on the electromagnetic spectrum. So so we had built these instruments, and long and behold, we discovered there were bursts of gamma rays up there. And then it took several decades to figure out, because they are incredibly bright, just incredibly bright. If you put a detector up there, you sort of have a background hiss like you might get from a radio, just background. And then about once a day, there's suddenly, you know, a large blip or maybe many, many blips in a row, and then it goes quiet again.
Now, when you say bright, you're not talking about visible light. You're talking about these bursts
of gamma rays
that are detectable through these other instruments.
Right. Suddenly there's a large number of gamma rays show up in the detectors, and with so many that initially we thought, just like right now, if we suddenly saw a very, very bright light, which you can't do on radio, I guess, but if we suddenly saw a very bright light, your first assumption is, well, it's probably very close to you. They were so bright that we assumed they were close by, which I mean in our galaxy, you know, maybe 10,000 light years away. But then with experiments, we discovered that they were not 10,000 light years away, that they were literally coming from the other side of the universe. Right now, gamma ray bursts, and in fact, with instruments that Los Alamos helped build, are the furthest detected objects ever. We have seen them at a distance of 13.3 billion light years, and the universe is only 13.7 billion light years old. So this light has been traveling to us for almost the entire duration that the universe has been here. So they're really just the furthest objects possible, and they are the very first stars that were ever formed. So it was in the late 90s that we finally figured out that they're actually coming from very, very far away galaxies.
And what is making those gamma rays?
Yes, that was the key question. Well, it turns out that all of the brightest objects in the universe, all the brightest objects in the universe are black holes. Now, that might seem strange.
Yes,
because,
it does.
Wait a minute, we just said they're black, and now you're telling me, you know, they're the brightest objects in the universe. But it's true. Black holes are the brightest objects in the universe. And the reason has to do with they have very, very strong gravity, and they're very, very small. So right now, if I stood up, the gravity at my head is a little bit smaller than the gravity at my feet. Because my head's a little bit further away from the Earth. But it's, you know, infinitesimally difference. But if the Earth shrunk down to a black hole, it'd only be 2 inches in size. And if I was near it, instead of, you know, I would weigh about 35 billion tons. The force of gravity would be about 35 billion tons, okay, if the Earth was only 2 inches in size as a black hole. And then the force on my feet is so much different than the force on my head, they would just rip me apart. It would rip everything apart. And that's what black holes are doing. These black holes can rip stars apart because of the difference in gravity on one side of the star compared to the other side of the star. So black holes are supposed to be black. That's true. They are down near the center of them. But the gravitational field is so strong that the differences in the gravitational field are so strong, it can rips everything apart, and therefore large explosions, large production of energies, and that's how they end up being the brightest objects in the universe.
When I hear people talking about these phenomena, I can't help but think, what is the nature of this knowledge? Is it fundamentally knowledge for its own sake? Does it have anything to do with us in any kind of practical way?
It certainly helps us learn other things about the universe, particularly gamma ray bursts, because they are the brightest objects in the universe, they are the furthest objects in the universe, and therefore they do things like they light up the entire universe. When a gamma ray burst goes off, it lights up the entire universe between us and that spot, and we can study, for example, how the universe evolved. But if you ask, does this grow better corn in Alaska? No. No, it doesn't. But a lot of the instrumentation that we've developed has had other applications. We've had to develop a lot of gamma ray imaging techniques, for example. And then those gamma ray imaging techniques have been used in other applications. We've learned things like how to make very robotic systems. These gamma ray bursts last sometimes only a hundredth of a second, and sometimes they last 100 seconds. Tremendous dynamic range of how they react, how they look. So because of that, 100 seconds, if you have a satellite trying to see a gamma ray burst, you can't have humans interacting with it. It has to be completely autonomous. We build a whole series of satellites that are up, not satellites, telescopes that are up in Fenton Hill in the Jemez Mountains, and they all have to be robotic. So we have these, we've learned how to develop completely autonomous, completely robotic systems for looking at these things, because humans are just too slow to react and say, oh, one just went off, let's go investigate it. Too bad, it's over.
It's over.
It's over and gone, and you've lost it. Okay, so we've developed a lot of technology in order to be able to observe these gamma ray bursts, which are actually the birth of a black hole. I mean, in this particular case, for gamma ray burst, it's a very early star in the very early universe, which is collapsing into a black hole and producing jets of gamma rays as it's collapsing.
We have some concept, as you discussed, about the size of the universe, and what is the nature of the boundary of that universe?
Well, it sort of doesn't have a boundary. And that's tied up in
if it doesn't have a boundary and it's just space, what does the concept of size mean?
Yeah. The space itself is expanding. So the Big Bang, the whole universe was created out of a tiny little spot 13.7 billion years ago, out of the vacuum. And again, we go back to your comment earlier about, that's strange. I thought a vacuum was sort of nothing. No, it turns out vacuum has a tremendous amount of stored energy because it had the capability of producing this entire universe out of a vacuum. But that space itself has expanded, and the space itself is stretching and being expanded by the explosion out of the Big Bang.
So, which is, again, tricky for the radio listener to understand, because that's not matter itself. Yeah. I mean, we think of things that expand are cakes or balloons or things.
Right. And this is literally the space itself. Absolute vacuum is doing the expanding. But it's what we've... I mean, it's not so much that we wanted it to be this way. As with many complex things, this is actually the simplest answer. I mean, there's Occam's razor that, you always go with the most simplest answer. And this may not look simple to the casual observer, but as you put all the evidence together, we go, gosh, this is how the universe is. There's no other way to explain it other than to explain it's such as, space has certain properties. It's actually four or higher dimensions, with time as an integral dimension with the space, and they're all expanding together.
Ed Fenimore is an astrophysicist and a laboratory fellow at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.